Second and final hour of October 16th, 2022, Liberation Station Radio Show. Chris Steiner with you, and bringing back also with you in just a few moments, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, interviewed on the last edition of the Peter McCullough's McCullough Report at America Out Loud, the October 11th, 2022 edition. And the second hour on Facebook, audio is streaming properly. So that's good to see, and we'll just stream live there if folks want to comment. Post the whole show on the Republic Broadcasting Facebook page after the show, facebook.com/Republic Broadcasting. We'll do that within about an hour or two after the show, and catch up with posting last week's show as well. So things take some time when there's video editing, there's post-production that needs to be done. If you'd like to call in as quickly as possible before we resume this clip, or we'll take your call after the clip, right after the clip, it's 512-248-8252, 512-248-8252, and toll-free 800-313-9443, 800-313-9443. And we'll get back to this excellent education that Dr. McCullough, who's so well educated already, is getting from Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. And I think that's why I think this is a good clip to share with folks who are questioning vaccines. At least they're questioning. And they can see that someone as educated as Dr. McCullough isn't aware of a lot of what Dr. Tenpenny is catching him up to speed on. Now that he's more receptive, and I forgot to mention in the last hour that Dr. McCullough did finally come out and say that he is not going to administer, recommend not just COVID shots, but any vaccine to for his friends or his family, his patients. And so that's wonderful news to hear him come out and say to someone who is questioning vaccines that, hey, look, this is the history. This has been going on for a long time, this death and destruction, deprivation of rights, coercion for people to be able to feed themselves or house them, home themselves. People not able to feed themselves, homeless in their own bodies, and those who are taking the shots in another way are homeless in their own bodies. Kind of like that fellow in the last edition we played, the Pfizer executive. I mean, the executive who does business with Pfizer. And he's admitting that he didn't agree with the science of any of the COVID shot makers, and he took the shot anyway. So it's not like the old-time slavery, where at least they house and feed you. People who are executives, high-end executives, I find, often have the same mindset as homeless people. Homeless people so desperate and yet selective of who, from whom they will accept help. If there are any strings attached, they're a lot like, you know, maybe work involved, they're a lot less likely to accept help, even if it's just a tiny bit of help, because they're so used to getting things free, even if they're lower quality, say in terms of food, they're, you know, in terms of being fed, they'd rather go to a food bank and get a lower quality than work for food. And not to shame them, I'm not condemning them. I know that it's what people call laziness is their lack of morale, their desperate fear of not being approved of for doing a poor job. And that's why they've lost their work ethic. That's the biggest problem, is not that they're lazy, the lack of morale. And it's very difficult trying to work with those who are willing to work, who are homeless sometimes, but at least they try. You know, they're ones I've worked with are, you're gentle with them. They're willing to admit that they're afraid of making mistakes, even though those are simple. It causes them to make simple mistakes, fear, very simple mistakes that makes you wonder, are they trying to do it on purpose? And so you have to remind yourself, no, these are basically children and adult bodies. They need to relearn or learn those those skills that allow for a good working environment, not fear of retribution at every turn. So, it's kind of like calling into talk shows. You got to get out the most impactful things, but they have to be said in a calm voice in the hopes that they will learn, that the host won't be able to get under your skin. And so you want to be able to give them the advice, deliver same words, but in a low tone of voice. Things that you would can imagine yourself blowing up at them, shouting, but you just translate that into a low tone of voice, and the results are much different and much better, much better results when it comes to teaching. Whether it's somebody in an executive position, a talk show host, the listeners, because of course you're doing it for the listeners, you're doing it all for the listeners, and making sure that make a professional presentation. But when it comes to high-end executives, they're desperate to make a sale. They're desperate for keeping not what little they have, like a homeless person, but they're desperate just for easy prey. And similarly, that's what homeless people are. They're looking for easy prey when it comes to someone who will help them, someone who will give them specifically what they ask for. And if they don't get their demands met, they often won't want to talk to me anymore and try to offer them a little bit of help. And they want something very specific, and they want to be very selective. But it's difficult because it's a situation where they have the mindset of depravity, of being depraved, not of abundance. And that's where it all comes back to economic reform. But I won't get into that. Without further ado, we'll continue the clip. I just wanted to make those observations. Of those who are so desperate to keep what little they have, those like the Pfizer, the executive who does business with Pfizer, that those projects, Veritas, secretly recorded in a public setting. So it's admissible evidence in court, of course, allowable on the Internet. It's not a violation of privacy, since it was a public place in which it was recorded. It was a restaurant. So that kind of willingness to speak, maybe when he had a few drinks, and willing to, not ashamed to admit what his conscience, or maybe his unconscious, of being brought to his conscious. And the reporter is aghast and expressing repeatedly her astonishment that he would give up his health for the COVID shots that he admitted he didn't think had enough research. And so let's continue on with that clip of how vaccines in the history leading up to the COVID shots haven't been given due research with this Dr. Sherry Tenpenny interview, the last America Out Loud edition of the McCullough Report, October 11th, 2022. And resume that clip, please.
CHEACT, 1986, theact.com. And it's a marvelous documentary. And it really is something, if people aren't familiar with it, that they should go out and find it and watch it. It's about a two-hour documentary that shows how the pharmaceutical industry co-opted Congress to get complete liability protection for not only the three shots that were already on the schedule, but for every shot they put on the pediatric schedule going forward. In the documentary, it's a very well done documentary, Peter, because it's the story of a husband and wife that had waited a very long time. They had a hard time getting pregnant. They finally got pregnant, and the mother was like, "Well, what are we going to do about vaccines?" And the dad was like, "Well, of course we're going to vaccinate our child." And she said, "Really? Maybe we should look into this." And then it's their story, their journey about how they found out that there were never any safety studies done on any of the vaccines, how that they found out that effective was a word co-opted by the pharmaceutical industry, that effective, we as consumers and doctors think effective means prevents you from getting sick, but really in what it really means is it does what it's intended to do. Meaning when you inject a foreign matter into a child, it develops an antibody. And as long as it develops an antibody, they say that the vaccine is effective. Even though you can have very high antibody levels to any one of the pathogens that are injected and still contract that infection. So this effective, what we think means effective means when we say safe and effective, it's safe and it keeps you from getting sick. That's really in the vaccine research, really not what it means at all.
So let me just stop you there. So I pulled up the schedule. I want to make sure I'm on the record. I'm correct. So I was born in 1962. So that year, it was polio, the oral polio. It was smallpox. And I checked with my mom, and actually my mom said I did get the smallpox vaccine. And then it was diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. It wasn't even measles, mumps, and rubella then. That came in later on.
That came in about 65. Right. And the smallpox vaccine, we stopped giving it to the general population in 72.
Right. Now, so let me ask you. Of these illnesses, you covered measles. So measles is a skin rash. It had negligible mortality. But there was a theme. The theme developed was to overstate the seriousness of the illness in order to prompt and justify vaccination. But aren't some of these illnesses really serious? Let's take polio. I've seen patients in my practice, people I've known in life that have been paralyzed from polio. I've seen polio cardiomyopathy and the residual of it. Isn't polio a serious enough infection that we should promote vaccination for polio?
No, because what we're doing again is playing to the lowest common denominator. How many of those cases have you actually seen, Peter? A handful? A couple dozen?
And of course, it happened a long time ago as well.
And it happened a long time ago. The polio vaccine came out in 1955. And the peak of the polio infection actually dropped off by 1957. And in the United States, there's been no wild polio viruses in the United States. And the World Health Organization declared declared the Western Hemisphere polio free in 1991. But we still give children four doses of this shot to protect them against a virus that isn't even in the environment here. There's one other thing about that is that polio, actually 97%, and this is information that comes directly from the CDC. You get their pink book. Their pink book is all about all of the different shots and the childhood infections. The CDC's pink book actually says that 97% of people who were exposed to a polio virus, which is an enterovirus, back in the day when there was a lot of it around, more than 97% of people, it passed through as an asymptomatic infection. They had no symptoms whatsoever, and it went away. About 2% of people had what looked like either a stomach flu, maybe a little bit of food poisoning, it went away. Less than 1% had something that looked like a viral meningitis. and 0.02% of people who contracted a polio infection actually ended up with some form of paralysis. Most of that paralysis resolved within 2 years. So when you take those numbers and you really look at them, and those are numbers directly from the CDC's pink book that anybody can go and look up, when you play to that lowest common denominator, what you just said previously about overstating how the seriousness of an infection, you know, we're two generations away from that, Peter. And if you go out to a community talk and you say to the community, when I say the word polio, what is the first thing that pops into your head? Paralysis.
People in wheelchairs. Yeah.
Kids in braces, you know, FDR, you know, the iron lung, all of those different things. That was in the 1950s. Here we are, you know, 70 years later, and we still promote that visual, which is absolutely not even existing anymore.
But let me ask you. So the polio epidemic started to go down before the vaccines could have even have an effect. It was actually an initial failed polio vaccine. The there was a change, this so-called Cutter incident, where there was withdrawal. And so what explained the polio pandemic going down? Was it wastewater treatment and better hygiene, or what was the explanation if it wasn't the vaccine?
Well, that takes into the whole other consideration of what else was causing this paralysis. And there is a lot of evidence that points to what was actually happening was an exposure to DDT, to chemicals and pesticides. And there's all these pictures of when they would spray, because polio would be this big thing people were terrified of in the summer, and they didn't want people to go to swimming pools. And there's all kinds of pictures of going down the street and spraying DDT everywhere. And there was these television commercials that said, you know, little sing-songy things, DDT, DDT, it's good for me, good for me. And so there is evidence that points to the fact that what was happening with the paralysis was really a chemical poisoning that they pointed to a virus and said, see, that polio virus was causing this.
Geez, I've never heard that before. Let's take smallpox. So I got smallpox. You know, isn't smallpox a bad illness? Wasn't that a good idea to get a smallpox vaccine?
Well, smallpox actually was another one of those things. It's pretty interesting. I'm glad you're bringing these up, because honestly, whenever people are new to the topic and they really haven't taken a deep dive into this, one of the where it's always starts is, what about polio and what about smallpox? And the smallpox infections were, you know, when you look at the history of smallpox, it goes way back, way before Jenner. And when they first started, and actually it was a skin disease. And the reason that they wanted to have a vaccine to prevent it was that this virus had a predilection for the sebum glands on the face. So when the very wealthy in the late 1700s and the early 1800s would contract this infection, it would scar their face. Mm. And it was thought of as a filth disease, F-I-L-T-H, a filth disease among the very poor. So if the wealthy got this, contracted this infection, they were accused of cavorting with the very poor and hanging out. And so it was a filth disease that had to do with cosmetics. And that's where a lot of the Lady Montagu, who was the first person who tried to do this in vaccination thing in the late 1700s, she was in Turkey, and she was a friend of somebody in England, and they tried to do this engrafting where they would take a little scab off of the smallpox on the face, and they would take a little bit of the scab and they would inject it between the webbing of the fingers to try to give people some sort of a resistance to the smallpox. In fact, you know, smallpox inoculation along using the scab went all the way back into the like 500 AD, that the Chinese used to take the scabs of people who had this infection and grind it into a powder and have them snuff it up their nose. Mm. And if people, and some people seem to get some sort of a protection from that.
And we'll pick up that interview, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny speaking with Dr. Peter McCullough, when we get back here on Liberation Station Radio Show. Stay tuned.
Never said a word now. You know they never said a word. Still they have to die. Well, I'm asking why. It won't be.
For the past 14 years, it's been my privilege to host the National Intel Report on RBN, to offer a platform to interview exceptional guests, to provoke critical thought, and examine evidence, whether real, fake, or somewhere in between, and allow our audience to call in and participate with your input and questions, in order to help us all reach an educated decision and arrive at our own truth. Our world has changed. It's now been turned on its head. Real is now considered fake, and mainstream fake is now pushed as real, rather than any clear thinking, consensus, or rationale.
Those few remaining beacons of light, the ones still shining through the mainstream media lies, propaganda, and deception, are being viciously attacked at every level through attempts at censorship, threatening advertisers, jailing hosts, and even killing journalists brave enough to speak the truth to you. We are in a war for our very freedom and existence, and through these despicable acts, freedom haters, collectivists, and communitarians have shown they will stop at nothing to blot out these last few beacons of light. Truth is becoming increasingly more difficult to unmask, just as the term unmasking itself is spoken by those usually anonymous sources. They promote their lies, wishing to mask the truths by ignoring it, vilifying it, or conspiratorializing it into a black hole abyss.
Regrettably, RBN has reached the tipping point, and through internal audit and actuarial review, it has now been determined that the only life raft of survival to this network is to go the way of PBS, that being audience supported. Like a cornered animal, the left with veracity is pulling out all the stops with every effort to effectively blacken our beacon forever. Help us, folks. Help yourselves. Don't let our light stop shining. Our motto has always been, because you can handle the truth. It's time to review your budget, folks. If you want the truth to keep flowing through RBN, go to republicbroadcasting.org and become a regular monthly donor of 30, 40, 50, or 100 or more a month and ensure you keep the truth flowing.
Are you one of the millions of people who feel like there is a dark cloud hanging over their heads whenever they're using pharmaceutical drugs? For some, the short-term relief can turn into an opioid addiction nightmare. Have you ever wondered why CBD oil is a billion-dollar industry? It's because it works better than opioids and is actually healthy for you. However, CBD oil is stripped of all other helpful compounds found in the hemp plant. According to neuroscientists, the whole hemp plant, otherwise known as hemp paste, is even more effective than the chemically processed CBD oil. Are you ready to take back your health? You can try hemp paste for the price of a cup of coffee by going to rbnhemppaste.com and ordering a trial pack of Happy Packets for $5 with free shipping. That's rbnhemppaste.com.
Back here. We're returning now on Liberation Station radio show and the interview on the McCullough Report, last edition, October 11th, 2022, with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. So when you're ready there, Sam, in the control room, please resume that clip.
You know, viral encephalitis and died. And so this is, it is a very, very long history about smallpox. And it wasn't until, you know, that when Jenner came out with the smallpox vaccine in the early 1800s, it was always about medicine, power, and money. I mean, Jenner was given, the doctors of the day in the early 1800s that looked at what Jenner was trying to do with taking the cowpox virus and scratching the underbelly of a cow, taking the cowpox virus and wiping it underneath the belly of their cow, making it fester and be like pus. Then they would scrape off that pus and they would and they would make hash marks with non-sterile scalpel blades, because they didn't have sterility things at that time, into the mother's arm, scrape the pus off of the belly of a cow or off the bottom of a horse hoof, smear it on the mother's arm. And when it got all big and fustery, they would scrape that off and jab it into infants 3 months of age. That was what early smallpox inoculation looked like. They called it arm-to-arm inoculation. And so at the same, so many of the doctors at the in that era, when they would look at this, they said, I did that to my patients. They got sicker than a dog, and they got smallpox anyway. This stuff doesn't work. And they tried to throw it out from the very beginning. But Parliament was very much in favor of this. And the doctors that were in Parliament said, this is the first procedure and the first thing that we can go and do and make money on. And Jenner was given 10,000 British pounds in 1801 to develop this entire industry. Well, if you can imagine, I mean, 10,000 pounds today is a lot of money. It was the equivalent to a couple of million dollars back then to develop this entire industry. And so it was money, power, and politics. And at the same time, so fast forward to 1853, which was the first mandatory vaccination law that was passed in the UK. And at the same, in the same year, because they, the more that they vaccinated, the more they spread the infection, because this was a live virus that they were just spreading everywhere. And in 1853, they passed the first mandatory vaccination law. And in that very same year, in 1853, was the first anti-vaccination program that was set up. It was called Our Baby's Battle, and it was started by parents whose children had been maimed or died from gangrene from these horrible shots. So the anti-vaccination movement, mandatory vaccination, politics, money, government is in the actual DNA and fabric of the entire vaccination industry going forward. And in my opinion, it's why physicians can't get their head around the idea that this is not good, because it was, it's the part of the very DNA of physicianhood that goes all the way back into the mid 1800s.
It's been baked in. Now let's have the other ones, because I want to just make sure we cover this. Diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. Let's take diphtheria in the modern day. Diphtheria in the modern day. Treatable illness?
Yes, by antibiotics.
Okay.
And there's less than four cases of diphtheria. Actually, it's a reportable disease, and there's less than four cases of reportable diphtheria in the United States per year. And yet we massively inject people with this diphtheria toxoid.
Okay. How about tetanus? I step on a rusty nail, I go into the ER, it gets cleaned out, and they give me some antibiotics, and they give me a tetanus shot. Is that going to do anything for me?
Probably not. Tetanus immune globulin, which they don't even have available in ERs anymore, was probably the best thing for very dirty wounds, particularly crush wounds or road rash or things like that. And back in the day when I was an ER doc, we had that available, and you would take the tetanus immune globulin, which is, for those that are listening, the actual, just the antibody that's already been made to the tetanus toxoid, and you would inject it right into the wound. So if there was, because tetanus is a toxoid-related infection. It's like a little spore that the tetanus, the Clostridium tetani, balls up and gets like a little spore, goes into your a dirty, dirty wound, and it's not just off of a rusty nail. That's another thing that we've impregnated into people's brains. And then that spore has an opportunity to germinate and unwind and produce something called tetanospasmin. And tetanospasmin is the strongest neurotoxin known to man. It's stronger than botulism, it's stronger than all of them. So tetanus toxoid, when you get a tetanus shot, is designed to create an antibody to go against that little spore, if that spore is there even at all. And the other thing I think people need to know about tetanus, you know, I've seen it. I'm sure you have too, Peter. People that would cut their finger washing dishes in warm, soapy water, and yet they would bolt out of their house to the ER and sit in an ER for 4 hours if necessary, just so they could get a tetanus shot. I mean, tetanus is another filth disease. It's a dirty disease. You need to clean it out. The death rate from tetanus is negligible. I mean, CDC stopped tracking it, in the 80s.
And we'll hold it right there. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, interviewed by Dr. Peter McCullough. We'll be back for the final half hour Liberation Station radio show. I'm Chris Steiner. Stay tuned.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Hello, I'm Dr. Leonard Horowitz. I was right 30 years ago in warning the world about threatening lab virus outbreaks, AIDS, and Ebola. I was right 20 years ago when FBI Director Robert Mueller made me a suspect in the anthrax mailings because I warned the Bureau before the CIA's biocrime and Cipro sales psyops happened. I was right about COVID-19 being an AIDS-laced mutagen plan to resurge this fall to excuse officials' profitable depopulation globalization agendas. And I was right about the only safeguards being antioxidants and holy spiritual sustenance. Vitamin C, D, zinc, chlorophyll, oxygen, and oxysilver especially transmits the frequency resonance to neutralize the expanded function bioweapon. Oxysilver is a double superconductor of the healing power of love. It is the first nutraceutical invented to amplify prayer power and the faithful loving intention of your heart. Buy, try, and stockpile OxySilver through HealthyWorldStore.com.
My name is John. I'm the founder of Blackout Coffee, and I started Blackout because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have like all of the coffee. It's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
Visit blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Some people need their fears. They think it makes life clear. No one's on earth alone, yet everyone's on their own. You're everything that I am, I adore. It's the reason the light's for. It's my heart that I need to be sure. Keep it pure.
And we're back in Keeping Your Heart Pure, Free of Myocarditis, which I see on Twitter is trending up. Don't want to get one of those one-stop commie clot shots. Say one-stop in the eyes of those who receive them, those recipients who think that it's a substitute or could substitute any part of their nutrition. You don't have a vaccine or a drug deficiency. You just take this one-stop shot. And we'll pick up this clip here of Dr. Tenpenny being interviewed by Dr. Peter McCullough, play the trailer for the new documentary on the plandemic, casedemic, scamdemic. It's called Safe and Effective, A Second Opinion. It's just about a 2.5-minute clip. You can check it out at oraclefilms.com/safeandeffective, and also on YouTube, you can watch the whole documentary for free. So that's a great compliment to the Plandemic series, part number 3 of the Plandemic series, coming out soon, plandemic-3.com. All right. Well, Pat, I see Pat in Texas called, so we can squeeze in your call. You just have 25 minutes more left of this clip and this interview, so we might not have time to play that trailer. Whenever we do on the next show, when we'll play that and get into a bit of a description, a teaser for it, has a lot of great information. So, Sam, please continue that interview of Dr. Tenpenny by Dr. Peter McCullough.
It was so negligible.
While we're on the show, I do want to bring up my co-author of my book, Courage to Face COVID-19, John Leake, who's a historian. He has pointed out that when the tsunami hit in East Asia, in Banda Aceh, all these people were cut and scraped by all this, you know, dirty corrugated material and nails and wood, and that there were people in Banda Aceh who died of tetanus. And it's been claimed that, boy, if they had a broad-based tetanus immunization, it could have made a difference. Is there any truth to that? Have you heard that before?
I haven't, but this is one of my problems with that statement, broad-based tetanus vaccination. So we need to give a tetanus shot to multiple millions of people on the outside chance a couple hundred may have needed it.
Yeah. And there would have been a tsunami. Who would have guessed that? I mean, my point is this. Listen, we get a deep tissue wound infection. We get it cleaned out. Sometimes we get antibiotics. Sometimes it's not needed. But it's a clinical call, and it's a treatable illness, right? It's a treatable illness. Now, I want to move on and fast forward. I'm looking right at the schedule. Someone had sent this to me, the vaccine schedule I'm talking about. And in 2019, and I'm counting over 70 different administrations of vaccines. Now, out of the 70, 18 of them are influenza. That is vaccinating children for influenza. Can you give some commentary there?
Sure. We started to give giving children 6 months of age. We started getting them the influenza shot in about 2004. And quite frankly, I think that part of the impetus for putting that into the pediatric schedule was, again, the 1986 Injury Compensation Act, because that the pharmaceutical industry is only protected if that shot is in the pediatric schedule. For example, there are big class action lawsuits going on right now over the shingles vaccine because of all the people that have gotten injured from the shingles vaccine, which they cannot put into the pediatric schedule. So here we are with influenza shots all out there given to adults all the time, and they were starting to get lawsuits about people that got Guillain-Barré and various things from influenza shots. And so the pharmaceutical industry said, whoa, we need to button that one up. Let's roll that influenza vaccine into the pediatric schedule, which they did in about 2004. And all the multi-dose flu shots still have mercury in them. And they've gone from trivalent shots to quadrivalent shots, which they've pulled the quadrivalent shots off the market on and off multiple times because that fourth virus seems to be very inflammatory and causes a lot of reactions in a lot of different people. But they keep dinking around with the formula to get it right. So now we start with flu shots in children. And if it's the first one they've ever had, you give them two. You give them one, and then, like, you know, 6 weeks later or so, you give them a second one. And we know that the viruses morph and change every year. I mean, that's why we promote giving flu shots again every year, because the viruses that are contained inside of those flu shots morph pretty regularly.
And does the flu shot, is it substantially effective? Has it ever been shown to be effective?
It's a substantially ineffective. In fact, I looked at CDC. One of the things that the government is really good at is data entry. I mean, you can find tables for just about anything you want inside of our government databases. And the CDC every year tracks influenza illness. And how that works, Peter, is there's about 120 testing stations across the country. So if you get what appears to be the flu, you know, deep body aches, fever, cough, you know, all those different things, if you go to one of those testing centers, you get a nasal swab and a throat swab, and they send it to the CDC for tracking. The CDC tests about 600,000 swabs per year. And then that first set of testing, when those swabs come in, the first thing that they do, they take the Q-tips out and they test to see, is this a influenza virus or something else? You know, if that, so the first thing that they do is they test it. If it's an influenza virus, that goes over into another part of the lab where they subtype it to see if those influenza viruses out in circulation making people sick match those viruses that are in the flu shot. That's where that data comes from that we hear on the news. You know, this year the flu shots are 34% effective or 27% effective. That's where those numbers come from, those initial swabs. Is it influenza-causing illness or not? I looked at 19 years worth of data that they separate out in that first swath of influenza or not. It's only influenza causing illness on average about 14% of the time. 86% of the time, it's some other virus, some other thing, some other bacteria that's making people sick. So if the flu shot, and then you take that 14% of the time that it's making people sick out, then you subtype it and say, well, now it's only 25% effective. Well, then that means 25% of 14% is how much the flu shot is going to protect you, which is negligible.
Well, let me just, I always give our listeners, they're used to this, cite some evidence. So MMWR, March 11th, 2022, first author is Chung. The title of the paper is Interim Estimates of the 2021-2022 Seasonal Influenza Vaccine Effectiveness in the United States. The overall calculated vaccine efficacy, as you in line with your statements, last year was 16%, Sherry, 16%. The 95% confidence interval spanned from minus 16% to 39%. So that means it's considered statistically no different than zero. It's no different than zero. Statistically insignificant, no different than zero. So if it's no different than zero, why would anybody take a vaccine? And my understanding is from year to year, it's not much different. It has very low vaccine efficacy.
Yeah, like I said, I looked at those numbers over just raw data over a 19-year period of time and put together a table that showed that, you know, 600,000 swabs tested, you know, of those 600,000, only on average over that 19 years, 14% of them were influenza viruses, which means if that flu shot was going to protect you at all, it's going to work 14% of the time. And then if it doesn't match, if it doesn't match or it's a really poor match, it protects you even less. But yet we push the flu shot like it's some miraculous thing that's going to keep you from getting sick.
But let's stay on this for a second. I mean, I've been told as a general axiom that a vaccine should have at least 50% vaccine efficacy to even be worth it, meaning it's got to give you at least a greater than 50% chance for some protection. Otherwise, if it's so low, in this case, is if it's no different than zero, and then if there's any side effect with the vaccine, since it's no different than zero on efficacy, any safety event, one safety event, would be one event too many.
That's exactly right. Exactly right.
So, I mean, this is really a stunning revelation. So you and I come from two different places. You never took a single vaccine. I took all of the vaccines. In medical school, we were just taught to accept them as safe and effective, really with no challenge, no critical thinking, no critical review. I don't remember any type of critical review on this. And looking through some of the others, just to make sure we cover them, hepatitis B. Hepatitis B is an antigen-based vaccine. I remember I had needle stick injuries during residency. I worked in the cardiology cath lab, lots of exposure to blood and body fluids. I couldn't wait to get the hepatitis B vaccine. I thought, boy, if I got hepatitis B, I'd be in deep trouble. My mind said, listen, if there was an HIV vaccine, I'd get it because I wouldn't want to contract HIV and hepatitis C all the same. And so I took the hepatitis B vaccine. I took the series of them. I think I checked my antibodies and it ran low and I got a booster. But now I see hepatitis B vaccine is given on the day of birth now, Sherry, the day of birth, not restricted to cardiologists or surgeons or drug abusers or people with blood and body fluid exposure, but to children, actually an infant on the day of birth. What's going on here?
Well, that started in 1991. You know, what I said, when they passed the 1986 Injury Compensation Act, that gave them carte blanche to do whatever they wanted with any vaccine going forward. In 1991, they developed this hepatitis B vaccine. and they decided to give it to children at birth. And when you read that paper, that original paper, Peter, that came out in 1991, it's an 18-page paper. The conclusion of that paper is that we should give this hepatitis B vaccine to children at birth because hepatitis B is endemic in Southeast Asia. At that point in time, in 1991, there were only 14,000 cases of hepatitis B in children between the ages of 0 and 18. So if there's 4 million live births per year, 4 times 18 is, you know, out of 80 million children, there were 14,000 cases that had been reported, probably children of mothers or parents of IV drug abusing, you know, or prostitutes or people where that virus was endemic in our population here in the U.S. And so we decided to start giving it at birth. Congress actually held a hearing about it and said, where's your data? Show us where you have done any testing on safety at all in this population in one-day-old babies. And they said, well, we didn't test it on children. We only tested it on 5 and 10-year-olds. And Congress gave them an order to go back and say, take this off the market until you tested it for safety on infants, which they did not do. And if you look at the graph, the hockey stick graph that started, because at that point in time, there was a lot of aluminum in the hepatitis B, which we are, you know, we give vitamin K at birth, which some of those brands of vitamin K have 100 micrograms of aluminum in them. And then you give 200 micrograms of aluminum in a hepatitis B at birth. Imagine what you're doing to the central nervous system, the brain, the heart, the kidneys, the undeveloped kidneys in infants that are hours old. And you whap them with that much aluminum. They never took it off the market. And when you go back and you find those old graphs, the autism graph started to hockey stick up. At one point in time, probably 5 years into this, they had a manufacturing issue. They took it off the market for a while they were fixing the manufacturing issue. And you started to see that hockey stick of autism start to drop off. I'm saying that a lot of what was happening, not only was the hepatitis B that was given at birth, but the total amount of aluminum that gets injected into children. I mean, today, children, if they're fully vaccinated from birth all the way up to 18 years of age, they get 72 or 73 shots, depending on how you count some of the dosages. They get over 300 antigens injected, over 500 micrograms of mercury, and about 12,000 micrograms of aluminum injected into their body that just doesn't go away. And the lion's share of that happens up through about 6 years of age. So, you know, giving the hepatitis B at birth has never made sense. They actually even give it, like if mothers go in their prenatal care and they get tested for hepatitis B and it's negative, the doctors and the hospitals still insist that the mother must give their one-day-old infant a hepatitis B in order to discharge them from the hospital. In many incidents, I've heard hundreds of stories like that.
So we're deep into what is almost a historical frenzy over mass vaccination. None of what you've mentioned has been subject to a large prospective randomized trial of people getting the placebo injection versus the active vaccine injection. None of these have actually been proven in a randomized placebo-controlled trial to prevent the occurrence of serious illness. Many of the illnesses are not serious. In fact, they're treatable if they occur. Many are very rare. So we're left with the lack of a compelling argument on efficacy. And as you've mentioned several times, concerns over safety. So the trace metals never sound good. So mercury in things, aluminum in things, never, never. There's never a circumstance where that would be allowable. Is it just that the manufacturers would have to come up with new techniques or more expensive techniques to get them free of these trace elements? Or what's going on there?
Well, the idea that mercury was first used in shots back in the 1920s. I mean, they used that. It was supposed to be an astringent, meaning that the mercury would be in the vial, and it was supposed to keep the vials from being, you know, a multi-dose vial. So you're putting, you know, needles in and out. And if there was any sort of a contaminant of bacteria from doing that, the mercury was supposed to be like an astringent. Mm-hmm. And it's been proven unequivocally in many studies, it does none of that. But they never took the mercury out. Even in 2004, when we had all of the, you know, the Mercury Mom big movement that was like, we got to get the mercury out because it's really what's killing our kids. And Congress told the pharmaceutical industry, you need to go back and reformulate all these shots and take the mercury out. They never told the pharmaceutical industry, you have to do a product recall and pull every single one of your shots off the market that has mercury in them until you reformulate it. They just continued to inject mercury into children for another 4 years until they reformulated those products and took most of the mercury out.
Now, how about aluminum?
The aluminum is supposed to be in there as an adjuvant. The idea is that when you get a shot in your arm, the aluminum is supposed to hold that vaccine antigen in place in your arm long enough for the macrophages and the B cells to come by and look at that vaccine, at that antigen, at that pathogen, and to start to develop antibodies for that. That's the theory of what that's supposed to do, even though it's never been proven. And we now know that it doesn't hold the antigen there at all. And so that's the reason why there's, and the aluminum is in, you know, when they took the mercury out, they doubled down on the amount of aluminum that they put in the shots.
Yeah, you know,
I want to go back to what you said about the not having the double-blind placebo-controlled trial. We have petitioned the CDC for decades now, asking them for a full-out study, I mean, out of your, you know, $10, $12, $15 billion budget, to please do a study that shows the health of fully vaccinated children versus the health of completely unvaccinated children. And they refuse to do it because they say that that would be experimenting on children unnecessarily because we are withholding a known treatment of value from those unvaccinated children and they might get sick and die. And we can't possibly have a large population of unvaccinated children to compare their health status compared to the fully vaccinated that have asthma, allergies, eczema, ADD, ADHD, insulin-dependent diabetes, cancer, and on and on and on.
Or yeah, just anything that could have been spurred. And we know, let me give an example. Before COVID, I was largely just working in the area of heart and kidney disease. And so I lived through this whole era of just a disastrous administration of aluminum to dialysis patients. And the aluminum encephalopathy, they received massive amounts of aluminum. I remember in the course of my career, gold injections used to treat rheumatoid arthritis. You know, what we've learned over time is any installation of any metal in the human body is a bad thing. It is. It's just a bad thing. Even, you know, even the molybdenum that's in the total joint replacements, if it's not, you know, kept, you know, carefully and sealed in these joint replacements is a problem. Any metal's a problem. There's even actually adverse data on the old forms of dental fillings.
Yes.
So, you know, we're going to have to bring this to a close. But what I'm concluding, and again, this is wonderful because you came from a family and an environment where no vaccinations were given. About, I think the total estimates in the United States is roughly 2-3% of people are in that category. I'm in the other 97% where we took them all, but unquestioningly, and then through medical school, in a sense, we're indoctrinated. I'm starting to come to the conclusion that this is an entire house of cards. That this
absolutely.
This is a house of cards. It was built on a lot of incorrect assumptions. It never had randomized placebo-controlled data on efficacy or safety. And now there is this accrual of events that ecologically look like they're related to the vaccines. You mentioned neuropsychiatric disorders, but there's also asthma, autoimmune disorders, a whole variety of childhood disorders. You have the smoking gun, meaning these are given in the body. You can't take them out. You have the smoking gun that there's a trace contaminant, at least metal contaminant. That's real. So this is starting to build a compelling argument that the entire vaccine schedule, this is in trouble right now. And I saw some recent survey data that now a third of families, young parents, are starting to question this. And what's really spurred it all has been the COVID-19 vaccine disaster. And that's a topic for a different day. Would you agree with that, or, you know, have some final comments along those lines?
Yeah, a couple things. I totally agree with that. A couple things I want to mention. My parents were not like big anti-vaccine people. My dad was a chiropractor, and he got a lot of shots when he served in the Korean War. And when he went into the war and got the shots that they were given at that time, he got so sick, like within an inch of his life, that he said, I've never been that sick ever. So when he came back, and in the chiropractic literature in the 1950s, I was born in 1958. And so the chiropractic literature in the 50s was showing all of these children that were contracting paralytic illnesses from oral polio vaccines and all that during that time. And so he and my mom made the decision that they're like, we're not doing that. You know, my dad really believed in chiropractic and the health of the body. I grew up on Shaklee vitamins. I mean, he said, we just eat well and take care of her. I mean, she'll be just fine. I mean, these infections were always like rite of passage illnesses. Like nobody dies from this stuff. So that's how it was came to be that I wasn't vaccinated as a child. Was it wasn't that they were big campaigners. It was just my dad had gotten really sick and he said, I'm not doing that to my daughter. And so that's the one thing I wanted to mention. The other thing is that, again, I want to re-mention that the tenpennyresearchlibrary.com, it's a collection that I have been putting together since 2003. It's sort of like a collection of articles and links to articles that are like, I build it for a time such as this, that these are the things that people need to go and look at. And it's a free collection. All you have to do is register with your name and an email address. There's no charge for it. And it's got a two-layer search. So you can look at, and it gives the instructions. So like you can look at chickenpox vaccine and how many times has a chickenpox vaccine caused autoimmune disease. And you can go in and take a deep dive and dig into that. There's nothing in there from the popular literature or blog or any of that stuff. It all comes from peer-reviewed medical literature. So it's sort of like, why is it that physicians don't know this? In fact, when I first started doing this and putting this information out, Peter, back in probably the beginning of 2001, my first thought was, after I started digging through all this stuff, was like, surely, if physicians just saw this information, that was 20 years ago, if they just read the stuff in their own journals, they would start to question and go, wow, look at this. How could this possibly be? And I was kind of dumbfounded, and I still am to this day, that there's all this information that shows no safety studies, no efficacy, all the children that die or get maimed. I mean, all the different things that have happened. And physicians just put on their blinders and goose step to vaccinate. It's been a real enigma to me. And I think that everything that you said about being a house of cards, it absolutely is. And all the evidence is out there. We don't have to do any more studies to bring down the house of cards. It's already been done. We just have to look at it. Sort of like with the COVID shots. It's all that stuff. I started putting that out in May and July of 2021. All of those reasons that these shots can make you sick or kill you. And now every week, more and more studies come out. And people are like, wow, look at that. Huh, that must be something new. No, we've known it for at least over a year already.
Well, it would be certainly reasonable and fine, given the rarity of these things, to retire these vaccines, or many of the vaccines, start to kind of de-escalate here.
That's about the time.
You know, I think one of the first ones to go, or really just, you know, be completely elected as this influenza vaccine. It just
absolutely
has no track record of doing anything, and it is pushed.
All right, that's about all the time we have. Just maybe another minute or two. We had to cut off there at the end of the interview. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny with Dr. Peter McCullough. Well, I wish we had time for the more news. You've been tuned in to Liberation Station Radio Show. I'm Chris Steiner. The site is theliberationstation.com. And next week, I hope to squeeze in more news. Stay tuned every Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Until next time, I'll take great care.
In history, but have been somewhat forgotten by recent civilization. Susanna's Secret offers 100% pure and natural oils at prices you can actually afford. Do you have a house or office with a musty smell or mold? Studies have shown that essential oils like the one in our Thief and Robbers blend will kill or inhibit mold, viruses, bacteria, and fungus. Just diffuse with it, and you will see the long-lasting effects that even synthetic chemicals don't achieve. Purifica. Another one of our products used to clean and freshen your house or give a natural scent when drying laundry. For that special lady, we offer a ginger argan oil in a beautiful cosmetic bottle or a pure argan oil, a natural acne-fighting product. Check us out at SusannaSecret.com. That's S-U-S-A-N-A-S Secret.com. S-U-S-A-N-A-S Secret.com.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Truth, truth.